Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2023, and you're listening to episode 336, which is a conversation about the second century Christian philosopher and apologist, Athenagoras of Athens. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Lewis Marcos, who is professor in English and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University. He holds the Robert H. Ray Chair in Humanities. His 25 books include his book, Ancient Voices, An Insider's Look at the Early Church, which was published in 2022. Lou has written an online feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Athenagoras of Athens, and you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Lou, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Thanks, Melanie. It's great to be back.
Well, first of all, before we get into our topic, I just wanted to ask you kind of a larger, broader question, and that is, most Christians probably would find this topic not very exciting, and they would want to know, why should I care about early church fathers? They don't really see it has that much bearing on their life or their faith.
It is a good question, and it's something we need to really argue for. Now, the one main question is, we need to know the history of the church. Okay, Christ came, he gave us the Bible, but that doesn't mean everything is perfectly clear after that. The early church fathers had to fight hard to explain in clear terms the theology on which our faith is based. They had to work hard to be Christians in a society where they're part of that society, but not of it. They had to work hard to found the church. I think some, especially evangelicals like myself, we have this idea that snap your fingers and there's the church. Well, it took a lot of work to establish that church. But you know, Melanie, today, I think it's particularly important for Americans, especially evangelical Americans, to know the early church, because we're almost back to what they were like. They were in Rome in a very pluralistic society where there wasn't a sense of absolute truth, where there were competing gods, where people were living lives of immorality and justifying it. What I'm saying is that in a sense, we are living in the new Rome. And if we can study the way these early church fathers reacted to that, I think it will help us to understand, how do we live in a postmodern and in many ways a post-Christian society? And finally, really quickly, I still hear people saying this nonsensical idea that Christian theology was made up by Constantine at the Council of Nicaea in the fourth century. Well, if you read the early church fathers right from the second century, you will see they already understood the full nature of the gospel and were fighting for it. So there's none of this conspiracy theories of Constantine making it up. We need to know the foundations of our faith from the beginning.
Well, your article is titled Athenagoras of Athens, and I want to start out just asking you, why don't you introduce who he was? As I noted, he lived in the second century and he was a church father, but exactly who was he and why is he worthy of an entire article?
Well, Athenagoras is the third of three great early second century AD apologists. An apologist is someone who makes a defense of the Christian faith. In many ways, the Christian Research Journal is very much an apologetical magazine. It's helping us to defend the faith, what it means, how do we answer questions. These three, Athenagoras is the one we're focusing on, but he was preceded by a guy named Aristides and another one named Justin Martyr. And all three of these men, we often put them together because all three of them were not Jews. They were Greek pagan philosophers. They grew up studying Plato and Aristotle and Stoicism and all of the best of ancient Greek wisdom. And yet, they were converted to Christianity very much so because of the wisdom of the teaching of Christ, but also because of the moral lives they saw the Christians leading. And Athenagoras is important because, again, here is someone with a full Greco-Roman education. He comes to Christ. Here's why we need to learn from him, Melanie, especially today. We need to learn from him because when he became a Christian, he didn't say, okay, I wasted the first half of my life. Let me throw out this liberal art pagan education I got and only care about the Sermon on the Mount and nothing else. He didn't do that. He gave his life to Christ, but instead of throwing out his pagan learning, he took that learning and offered it up to Christ, just like Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, or more to our time, C.S. Lewis, who was taught by an atheist named Kirkpatrick, but he then took all the logic and rhetoric and all that stuff he'd been taught and used it to defend the Christian faith. So Athenagoras, the third of these three, was someone, he didn't abandon his education, he rechanneled it. So you're no longer a fisherman, now you're a fisher of men. You're no longer a Greek pagan philosopher, you're now a Christian philosopher who's taking what you learned and offering it up to Christ.
Well, you just mentioned two other people when you were introducing Athenagoras of Athens, and you mentioned Justin Martyr and Aristides. So can you talk about who they were and maybe what does he have in common with both of them?
Again, they were pagan philosophers. They were highly educated. They were sort of well-off people, and they could have gone on and lived a very easy life as a sort of elite educated person. Think of somebody from Harvard or Yale, whatever. But like Athenagoras, Aristides, Justin Martyr saw, it wasn't just the teachings of Christ. They saw the example, the truly moral lives of the Christians they met. And that converted them. As much as the gospel itself, it was seeing the Christian disciples living out that gospel in the real world. And all three of them, again, embraced the Christian faith. But like Athenagoras, they said, no, no, our job now is to use our pagan learning to defend the faith, particularly to defend the faith before the pagans. And all three of these men, we put them together because all three of these men actually defended the faith before the emperors in Rome, which is a pretty amazing thing. They got a chance to have an audience with an emperor and try to speak up and defend the Christian faith. And maybe we'll talk a little bit, Melanie, about these emperors, okay? Many people know that the first emperor to persecute the church was the crazy Nero. And in the 60s AD, he's the one that blamed the Christians for the great fire of Rome. He's the one that martyred Peter and Paul. Then the second persecution happened in the 90s by another crazy guy named Domitian. He's the one that killed more Christians, and he most famously exiled John to the island of Patmos. So that was the real bad persecution. As we move into the second century, though, there's still persecutions, but things get a little bit better because Rome was blessed with a series of good emperors. The first one was named Nerva. Then there was Trajan, then Hadrian, then Antoninus Pius, and then Marcus Aurelius. Most of the second century, we had these men who were fairly noble people. Many of them had a bent towards philosophy. And although there was some persecution, most of them adopted what we would call a don't ask, don't tell policy. If you Christians will just keep quiet, we won't persecute you. But Melanie, some of your listeners may know that what caused so much pain and death for the Christian martyrs was not so much these emperors, but there was a part of Rome called emperor worship. It was part of their sort of civil religion. And everybody was supposed to take a pinch of incense and sort of throw it in the fire to pay lip service to the divine emperor. That's all they had to do. All of them had their own gods. But of course, the Christians couldn't do this. And all, I mean, it's amazing, Millie, some of these emperors, particularly Hadrian, they even tried to stop asking these Christians. Just don't ask them. I mean, if you ask them and they refuse, then you got to persecute them. But they even made a rule at one point that anybody that falsely accuses someone of being a Christian will be put to death. So they were actually trying their best. But the trouble was that it wasn't just the emperors that hated the Christians. It was the crowds. They blamed the Christians every time there was a drought or something like that. Okay, I told you those three people. Aristides actually gave a defense before Hadrian, the third of those good kings. About 25 years later, Justin Martyr, who was later martyred, hence his name, he gave a defense before Antoninus Pius, and then our man for today, Athenagoras, gave a defense in front of Marcus Aurelius, right? And what they were trying to do is not exactly convert these emperors to Christianity. That would be like a later step. Their first step was just to convince the emperors, the leaders of Rome, that the Christians were good, moral people. Because, Melanie, there were rumors spread that because Christians called their fellow Christians brothers and sisters, they started accusing them of incest. And because they talked about the Lord's Supper of, you know, eating the body and drinking the blood of Christ, they actually accused them of cannibalism. So these people, particularly Athenagoras, now let's focus on him. He was someone who came forward and said, no, the Christians live good moral lives. They are intelligent. They're sort of philosophical. They think about what they're doing. They have traditions. They are not a threat to Rome. They are, in fact, good citizens.
I want to ask you, I think most Christians have probably heard at least, you know, of Socrates. That's probably the only Greek philosopher that most people, Christian or non-Christian, can name. And so did Athenagoras, Aristides, and Justin Martyr, did they have anything in common with him at all?
It really is fascinating, Melanie. And we as modern day apologists can learn from Athenagoras as well as Aristides and Justin Martyr. We can learn from them how to direct our apologetics towards a specific audience. So if Athenagoras is talking to Marcus Aurelius and trying to compare himself to, I don't know, David or Moses or Abraham, that's really not going to mean much to a Greco-Roman pagan audience who are not going to know the Old Testament. And even if they did, they're not going to look up to these people. So Athenagoras and the other ones, they very wisely compared themselves in their defenses to Socrates. And they actually, remember, they were Greek pagan philosophers before they were Christians. And Socrates is in many ways the father of philosophy in the West. There were some other pre-Socratics, but Socrates is really the father of philosophy in the West. He brought together metaphysics and morality and gave us what we think of as philosophy, or at least did till it was ruined. But anyway, so the reason they held up Socrates is that they're not just making this up. They very much saw Socrates as one of the first martyrs for monotheism. Now, they're not saying that Socrates knew Yahweh, okay? He didn't know that he lacked the special revelation of the Old Testament. But when you read Socrates, particularly his apology, his defense before the Athenian jury, the Athenian assembly, he is clearly moving away from the Greek polytheistic gods who are anything but moral, and he is moving towards God. And I think we can even use a capital G sometimes in Socrates and Plato after him. He's moving towards a single God who is the standard by which you can measure all that is good and true and beautiful. So they held up Socrates as someone who, like them, was standing up for a higher God, standing up for moral standards. See, Athenagoras, he knew, and he tries to explain that Socrates was put to death because they accused him of advocating foreign gods. Well, the Romans accused the Christians of being atheists because they only had one God, right? Well, pretty similar. They accused Socrates of making the weaker argument the stronger. Well, they accused early Christians of being sophists, lawyers in the negative sense of that word, of twisting the truth. No, we no more twist the truth than Socrates did. They also accused Socrates of corrupting the youth in the same way they accused the Christians of immorality, incest, cannibalism, and other things. And in the same ways that Socrates defended his beliefs and his way of life as moral and as actually higher than the pagans of his day, in the same way Athenagoras is making that defense before Marcus Aurelius.
As I've noted recently, we haven't had any new written reviews online at Apple Podcasts. It's been since last September, which has been quite a while. So I am just asking you, if you regularly listen to the podcast, please help us out and do us a big favor by going to Apple Podcasts and just giving a one-sentence review. Why do you like to listen to this podcast? What's your favorite thing about it? And, you know, as you know, life these days is driven by a lot of data, whether we like it or not. And that includes people finding out about this podcast. And the best way they can do that is if you rate and review it. Now, I know not everyone has time to write something, but we'd be really grateful if you did. But I would hope that you would be able to help us out, at least with a starred review. I want to just read the most recent review from September. The title is Informative and Interesting, and ShakaBoy07 says, I subscribe to the journal. The podcast helps me get to know the authors. The topics and conversations are interesting and relevant, very enjoyable. So thank you to that person for tuning in. Thank you to you for tuning in. And as always, we are really grateful if you could even give us a tip if you would like. And you can do that really easily at our website, equip.org. Go to Journal, follow Postmodern Realities, and at any of the landing pages, there's a link where you can give us a tip. Maybe you could give up a couple of lattes for the week or the month, or maybe pause your streaming service for a month and give us a tip of $5, $10, or $20, something like that. We'd be very grateful. Now, back to our conversation with Lou Marcos about Athenagoras of Athens. Well, earlier you were talking about why Christians should care about this topic, and just talking about how our time is not that unlike Roman society back in the day, which was very pagan and, you know, very licentious. And so are there actually anything that's a good thing, or what kind of virtues, if there were any, did the early church during that time share with Romans?
It's a good question. And here's an amazing thing, Melanie. So, you know, a lot of the society of Rome is doing this debauched stuff, but the Romans themselves, and especially their leaders, are holding up the old virtues and traditions of the Roman Republic. They still valued them. That doesn't mean they always followed them, but they valued them. So think of America in the 50s, right? There was still, you know, lots of, you know, adultery and all sorts of things that were going on, but at least America was holding up. This is what we believe a family should be. This is how husbands and wives and children and whatnot, this is the way we should behave. This is the way that even employers should behave and employees should behave. We didn't always follow those things, but we at least believed that there were values that we should live up to. Well, in the same thing, the Romans put a very high price or value on pietas, piety, but piety for the Romans actually meant more like duty. It wasn't so much an emotional thing as it was the duty that you owe to the ancestors, to the gods, to the state, things like that. They believed in duty. They also believed in unity as a good thing. And most of the early church fathers speak of unity as a good thing. You know, we're the body of Christ. They will know you are Christians if you have love for one another. They stress that. Both the Romans, at least when they were worthy of themselves, both the Romans and the Christians had a high respect for law and tradition. I get to do a lot of apologetics, and I've often found, Melanie, that if I'm talking to Asian Christians, I speak often for Koreans and Chinese and stuff, I found out that their favorite verse in the Bible is honor thy father and mother. Okay, if you want to make a direct connection between Christians and Asia, often you can say that, well, that's what Athenagoras was saying, trying to find things that we respect, laws and traditions that we uphold. Oddly enough, the Romans also did believe in religious tolerance. It was just that darn emperor worship that was a civic religion that made things so difficult. But generally speaking, they believed in that. And finally, and speaking of China, it's amazing that the communist Chinese often persecute the Christians when the Christians are always good citizens, okay? And the early church, they were good citizens. They reminded the Romans, especially the emperors, that Jesus told them, or Jesus and also Paul, that we are supposed to respect those in authority and pray for those in authority. And they reminded them of that. And most of the early Christians did just that. They were good citizens.
This is really interesting because you mentioned there was a sense in which piety in Rome was respected. So how did they, you know, some of these good virtues, how did they square that with such, you know, morality being so debauched? I mean, they had all kinds of sexual immorality that was, you know, quite shocking, not unlike what we live in now. Would you say that they're in a similar situation, like where we have people who would say that they're Christians, but yet live a life of debauchery? I mean, how could they have these good, you're mentioning that they had these certain good virtues, but how did they square that with actually what their society was like?
That's a good question, Melanie, and one we need to think of back then as well as today. And the thing is that just so often people say, you know, listen to what I say, don't look at what I do. But I think actually your question is very relevant to Athenagoras's defense, because Athenagoras reminds Marcus Aurelius, the emperor, that although the philosophy of Greece and Rome, the philosophical schools like Stoicism and whatnot, they were able to make their disciples smarter and more successful. But he reminds them that that kind of wisdom does not have the power to transform the individual. What I like about Athenagoras, maybe because he's later, is he moves past just a defense of the faith. And in his work, it's called A Plea, he moves forward onto the offensive and says, look, what Christianity has that none of the pagan schools of philosophy had, that even Plato and Aristotle or Cicero did not have, is the ability for God to be inside of us in the form of the Holy Spirit and transform us from within. The pagans obviously did not have access to the Holy Spirit transforming them. But Melanie, I hate to say it, but a lot of people today that claim to be Christians but live lives that are exactly the same as the world are people that are not allowing the Holy Spirit to transform them. Maybe they are saved, but they want to just go on living the way they are. And the Bible does say if we keep, you know, saying no to the Holy Spirit, we will actually sear our conscience. And the Spirit, I think, will just stop, right? So Athenagoras, we need to hear him today. He says, it is only because the Holy Spirit is within us, transforming us from within, that the Christians, he's now saying this, were actually able to follow Jesus and literally turn the other cheek, literally pray for the enemies. That's not something we can do out of our own human power. Only the Holy Spirit working through us and transforming us can do that. Another thing Athenagoras says is, you know, all of your philosophers are sort of these elite, rich young men, which is what Athenagoras used to be himself. But if you look among the Christians, you will see that this life-changing transformation is there in men and women, in the old and the young, in the rich and the poor, in the highly educated and the uneducated, that only the Spirit can transform us. And I just think we're in a situation, Melanie, where we don't want to be transformed. We want to just say, okay, I'm saved, and then live by the values of the world around us. I got to tell you something that really convicted me when I started reading all these early church fathers, especially in the second century. They took the Sermon on the Mount really literally. They didn't believe they were saved by works, but they expected their disciples to sort of live by the very high standard that Jesus set. So it's something that's, I think it gives us pause and makes us be a little bit self-reflective about ourselves and our own society.
Speaking of that, I kind of, this is a little bit off the beaten path from only talking about this, but as you teach this in the university setting, especially at a Christian university, do you find that it resonates with this younger Gen Z generation? Because it seems like of all the generations, they would feel even more removed from Christians in the second century, for example.
I think they do. The one thing that I do think touches them is I do think that they're looking for authenticity. I mean, all young people hate hypocrisy, but I think they're particularly seeing that hypocrisy. And they're not only seeing it in their parents, they're seeing it in the millennials that came just before them. And they don't want to be like that, okay? They want to be more authentic. I do think, Melanie, I'm noticing over the last 5 years that when I'm teaching, say, Homer, Virgil, Dante, and I get to the point where I try to give them what I call life lessons, I notice that they perk up even more than students from 10 or 15 years ago, that they are looking for direction. They're looking for authenticity, for transformation. They really do want justice. But unfortunately, all they ever hear is this social justice, which is basically Marxism with a veneer of Christianity. It's nothing different than what was called liberation theology 50 years ago. It's just all recycled Marxism. And they want justice, but all that's being offered them is this Marxist stuff. I think they're looking for a Christianity that can really change and transform and really build community. They are feeling the lack of community. Melanie, we have been lied to ever since the sexual revolution. Oh, no, no, the kids are fine with the divorce. That doesn't hurt them. Yes, it does. And it hurts them at whatever age they are. And they're still dealing with. They're still dealing with the brokenness and the fragmentation. And one of the things that they want to see in the early church is these people willing to give everything for Christ and willing to establish new kinds of communities that don't just fall into the same, you know, money grubbing and things like that. So I think there's some connection.
So I want to ask you now about his work specifically. So he has a work called On the Resurrection. And so can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. So far, Melanie, we've been really looking at a work he wrote called Plea for the Christians, P-L-E-A, A Plea for the Christians. That is very much an apologetic work, mostly defensive. A little bit of offense, but mostly defense. But we are so lucky to have another thing he wrote that he also presented to the pagans called On the Resurrection. And this, rather than being apologetics, is actually a little bit more theological. I think Athenagoras is important because I see him as the transitional figure between the apologists of the second century who were defending the faith and the theologians who would follow in the third century, people like Irenaeus, Tertullian, Origen, Clement of Alexandria, and reaching its climax, of course, with Augustine around 400. So Athenagoras is kind of the bridge between those two. He's not laying out a systematic theology as Irenaeus and Tertullian would, but he's already starting to think theologically. Let's move beyond just showing that Christians are moral and good citizens and intelligent, et cetera, et cetera. Now let's start thinking about theological issues. Let's start asking the big question. Let's show that Christianity is not only a way of life and a religion, but it also is a philosophy and a theology that has access to greater wisdom because it's got the direct revelation of the Old and New Testament, and it's able to move beyond that. So in this wonderful work on the resurrection, we're getting the real beginning of a more in-depth and unique kind of Christian theology that's borrowing from Greeks and Romans, but transcending them and moving into something that is uniquely Christian.
Now, he did write about the telos of man and man's purpose and how we're different from other parts of creation like animals. And so why did he write about that?
Let's talk about this because, all right, Plato and Aristotle, right? Aristotle is the one that really gives us that word telos, telos. It means end, but like in our language, you know, end can be when will this class end, right? What's the end point? But end can also mean, if I say, what is the end of this class? I mean, what is the purpose of this class? What am I trying to achieve? What am I trying to teach you? So the word telos has both of those meanings. It's a purposeful end. And one of the things that Aristotle did is he said that every creature has a telos. We are all born with a special purpose that we are seeking after. See, Plato talked about the forms, the perfection of things that are up in the heavens. What Aristotle did is put those inside. Every one of us is born, just like all Christians. And I would argue most people, even those who claim to be an atheist, believe that they're born with a purpose, and part of our job on this earth is to figure out what our purpose is, what it is we're supposed to do, what are our gifts, et cetera, et cetera. I think all of us have that innate sense. And what he's arguing here, and it starts with Aristotle, but it moves, is that the telos of man is different than the telos of animals. The telos of animals are a means to an end, right? They're there for us partly, but man is unique. Because each of us is an end in ourselves, right? Animals do their purpose and they die, but we are created to live forever, right? We have a telos or purpose that transcends anything else in nature. We're part of the animal world, right? We have bodies, we have flesh, but God has created us with a purpose, and that purpose will not be completely fulfilled until we're in the presence of God in heaven. So the vision of man is much, much stronger. There are intimations of it in Plato and in Aristotle, but Athenagoras is starting to show how much more the Bible and the revelation of Christ can teach us about our deep, innate purpose.
So in your article that you wrote for us, you noted that Athenagoras wrote that humans are enfleshed souls rather than souls trapped in a body. So why does this distinction, you know, apply to the resurrection of the body, for example?
I'm glad you asked that, because this is something we need to learn just as much as they needed to learn it in the second century. Melanie, I can't tell you how many Christians believe that when we die, we become angels. One of my very top 10 favorite movies is It's a Wonderful Life. Great movie, but bad theology. We do not become angels when we die. Angels are a totally different creation. First, God made angels, and they're purely spiritual. And then he made animals that are purely physical. And then God made us. We are not, as the Greeks thought, we are not souls trapped in bodies, and we just need to escape from the body and be free and float around on clouds. Too many Christians have that view of heaven. That is not a biblical Christian view of heaven. We are not souls trapped in bodies, but we are incarnational beings who are fully physical and fully spiritual. Now, don't confuse that with the incarnation of Christ. Christ is fully God and fully man. We're not fully God and fully man, but we are fully physical and fully spiritual. And that is why one of the most important teachings of the Christian faith is not only that Jesus rose bodily from the grave, but that we ourselves will have resurrection bodies. Now, if we die today, there will be a period in which we're disembodied, awaiting the second coming of Christ, the end of the world, and the resurrection of the body, when the body will come out and be reunited with the soul, and we will continue to be enfleshed souls. That is our destiny. That is our telos. That is our purpose. Melanie, a lot of people have this idea that when the second person of the Trinity, God the Son, when he agreed to the incarnation, whatever exactly the word agreed means, but when he agreed to the incarnation, he wasn't agreeing for 33 years. When Jesus died and went back to God, he did not go back to being pure spirit like God the Father or God the Holy Spirit. Jesus is for all eternity. Jesus will continue to be fully God and fully man, 100% divine, 100% human. He is in a resurrection body. He assumed our humanity, and he will do so forever. And we too, our destiny is to be not only a perfected soul, but a perfected body. And we will continue that way. This is something that the Greeks could not conceive of. Acts chapter 17 is when Paul gave his speech before the Areopagus in Athens and talked about the tomb to the unknown God. Every one of these apologists, Athenagoras, Aristides, Justin Martyr, is acting like Paul. They're not mentioning Paul when they talk to the pagans, but like Paul, they're building bridges. They're trying to show connection. But remember, The pagans are listening to Paul until he says that God gave proof that Jesus was the Son of God by raising him from the dead. And then they're like, what are you talking about? Why would anybody want to get their body back? We want to get rid of our body and be pure soul. And again, too many Christians think that. But that is not the teaching. And Athenagoras, very early on, is trying to give us a theology of the resurrection body following 1 Corinthians 15, which is the great chapter of the resurrection body that Paul writes.
Well, speaking of a resurrected body, that does also need to probably apply to the final last judgment that's talked about in the book of Revelation. And so, you know, why is it important that we do have physical bodies that are resurrected, both the Christians and the non-Christians? I mean, how does that apply to the final judgment, not just the life to come for Christians?
This is an important question, Melanie, and it's one that Athenagoras addresses directly. And I think we need to read him today because this is important to understand. All right. Again, we are not souls trapped in bodies. We are in flesh souls, fully body, fully soul, fully physical, fully spiritual. And that is who we are as a person. That means when we sin or we reject God or we are disobedient, it is not only our soul or only our body that does that. It is the enfleshed soul, the complex that we are, that either rejects God or accepts God. It is not just our soul. And if we are going to have rewards and punishments at the end, heaven and hell, if it only is a soul, then the reward is not being given to the person that did the good things or the punishment given to the person that did the bad things. The person who acted, who reacted, who disobeyed, who obeyed, that is the enfleshed soul. And so if there is going to be any justice, that which is in heaven or hell must continue to be the enfleshed soul. I hope that makes sense. It's a difficult argument, but it's a very important argument. And here it is in the second century AD. Already Christians are working hard to understand the full implications of what we believe as Christians. When we say, I believe in the resurrection of the dead, what fully, and of course the creed hasn't even been written yet, but they did believe in the resurrection of the dead right from the beginning. And this is one of the many reasons why that is important. The person in heaven or hell will be the person that made decisions on the earth. Otherwise, there is no justice.
Well, speaking of justice, I think that there's a lot of Christians today that would find that idea of someone having a physical body away from the presence of God in what we would call hell to be unjust. And that's why they would hold to annihilation. In other words, those people wouldn't suffer physically. They would just be destroyed. And then Christians, though, would continue to live on in the presence of God.
You know, I'd like to believe that, Melanie. I've read most of the books on annihilationism. And well, I will admit that they often do come up with some good verses to back up what they're saying. But Melanie, this is just my argument. I don't think anybody reading the Bible would come away with that. You only have to come up with that theory first and go back and look for proof texts. Because again, we need to understand who and what we are. Let me use a big word, ontologically, the nature of our being. God never created us to be a separate soul or body. We were created to be an enfleshed soul. And that is who we are as a person, as a creature made in God's image. And I don't know, it would be nice to believe in annihilation. I wouldn't go so far to call that heretical. I would call it maybe heterodox. But you know, maybe the answer comes somewhere in the middle, and that's in C.S. Lewis, who's playing off of Dante in The Great Divorce and saying that what is cast into hell is the remains of a human being. There's still someone there, but it's like there's not much left. It's like a shadow or a greasy stain on a window. I kind of like Lewis's argument. It's somewhere between the two. But again, what God made cannot just so easily be destroyed. God made us to be immortal and eternal. And so for there to be true justice, there needs to be consequences. Now, like I said, maybe the person in hell is so dehumanized, there's almost nothing left to them. We've met people like that on the earth, unfortunately. But a pure annihilationism just doesn't seem possible given the way in which God created us.
Earlier, you were talking about we were created for a purpose, and I want to ask you about this in the context of something from the Westminster Shorter Catechism. Now, I've mentioned on this podcast before, I happen to be a Reformed Presbyterian, and I do hold to the Westminster Confession and Larger and Shorter Catechisms. And just another piece of church history, in case some of our listeners don't know, but these catechisms were written in the 1600s, 1646, around there, and by the Westminster Assembly, which was a gathering of theologians and actually members of the English Parliament, which is kind of interesting to me because I don't think any of us could imagine now any form of government gathering with theologians to talk about theology and how that would impact their culture. But in the Westminster Shorter Catechism, the most well-known question, if anyone knows any of them, is the first one. And that question is, what is the chief end of man? And the answer is, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. So why does that, in the context of what we were talking about, an actual physical bodily resurrection for all people who have ever lived, how does that purpose of life really impact that doctrine of a bodily resurrection? And I will say to our listeners also is what I appreciate, especially about the Shorter Catechism, and they do have a children's version, is it was a good way for me to teach my children theology, even when they could barely talk. You know, I would have them memorize those answers. And as they got older, there was ways for me to talk to them about it, to ask them, you know, as teenagers, you know, how is your life being shaped to glorify God and enjoy him? How do you wake up today and enjoy God? And so how does that work in terms of, you know, the body and the soul together that you were talking about?
That's a great question. And I say that, you know, that is a good way to teach a children. I mean, Catholics have been doing that for, you know, centuries and centuries, right? In fact, when the Catholic kid is confirmed, they do their catechism. They've memorized their catechism and they speak it. And I think Protestants need to use that method more often. It's a tried and true method of question. What do kids do? They ask questions. They love why questions again and again and again. Okay, now, this Shorter Catechism is Protestant, right? Man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. But I want to show you that in the second century AD, Athenagoras says something like it. Here's just one sentence from his On the Resurrection. He says, "The final cause of an intelligent life and rational judgment is to be occupied uninterruptedly with those objects to which the natural reason is chiefly and primarily adapted, and to delight unceasingly in the contemplation of him who is God and of his decrees." That's pretty much the same thing as our chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. And now, there's a word for this that actually goes back to Plato. And that is the beatific vision. The word beatific doesn't mean beautiful, it means blessed. The beatific vision, or think of the Beatitudes, blessed are those. The beatific vision is the belief that the highest goal, they understood, Plato and Aristotle, that the highest goal of man is contemplation. It's even greater than the active life, it's the contemplative life. But here's the difference. For Plato, the ultimate is to contemplate the forms. That was Plato's idea, that in the heavens there is the form of truth with a capital T, beauty with a capital B, justice with a capital J. Now, that's a wonderful vision, Melanie, but what you are contemplating is finally impersonal ideas or forms. Thank God that the theologians of the church understood that, yes, we will contemplate, but not impersonal forms. Our greatest joy and desire is to contemplate the personal triune God, and we will contemplate and praise and enjoy him in the fullness of body and soul. You know, if we didn't fall, we probably would have still ended up in the New Jerusalem, ended up in God, praising him in our body. But because of sin and the fall, we have to die before we can do that. But I do think it was God's plan all along that we would be living directly in his presence and, again, glorifying and enjoying him forever. And again, we do this with the fullness of our being. But the fullness of our being is not just the soul, but the enfleshed soul.
Well, now, on a much lighter note, I have a personal question for Lou. And in the past, you've told us some of the things you're going to do during the summer. But this episode, I want to ask you, what's the best place you've ever traveled to?
Oh, my gosh. Well, of course, I love to go to Greece if we're talking about the world. But if we're just talking about our country, when my kids were young, we drove all over to the national parks. And I think my favorite place was Zion National Park in Utah. Just a place of unbelievable beauty. There's so much to see in our country. Get in your car, throw your kids in there, and travel around and see the beauty of our country from Yosemite all the way to Yellowstone to the Grand Canyon. But Zion was, to me, a little piece of heaven. And Zion, of course, is Jerusalem. So it was a little Jerusalem in America.
I just read today that I think international travel to Europe has exploded for this coming summer. And you just mentioned one of your favorite places, if you're talking about the world, is Greece. So why don't you briefly tell our listeners what's a must-see thing? Should they go to the ruins at Athens, or what's something that they would have to do in Greece, or maybe something they should also eat in Greece that's not as good in America?
First of all, you have to go to Athens. That's where most of the great stuff is. You have to see the Acropolis and all those other things. If you have more time, go north on a day trip to Delphi, where the Oracle of Delphi was. And if you have another day, go south and see the ruins of Mycenae, where Agamemnon ruled 3,200 years ago or so. There's not as much to see in Greece as in Rome. So you can do Greece in 3 or 4 days and see the most important things. And I mean, you do want to have your gyros or gyros, as we say, but try to eat, cooked food as well. I mean, most of what we think of as Greek is their fast food, which is delicious, okay? But they have things like pastizo and moussaka and other cooked meals that you certainly want to try when you're there.
Well, thanks, Lou, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thanks. It's so great to be back.
You've been listening to episode 336 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. And today I had a conversation with Dr. Louis Marcos of Houston Christian University. We talked about Athenagoras of Athens, and he has an article by that same title, which you can find for free at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube, with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that. And every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.